The Philadelphia Film Society supports WHYY and presents the 24th Annual Philadelphia Film Festival, PFF. From October 22nd through November 1st, PFF unites talented filmmakers and dedicated film lovers for 11 days of world-class cinema. From Sundance, Berlin, Cannes, and Toronto, PFF brings more than 130 new films from around the world to venues throughout Philadelphia. Ticket information and a full schedule of screenings are available online at filmadelphia.org/festival.
After three decades, one of Philadelphia's largest and most storied parcels of vacant land is now slated for redevelopment. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, the multi-million-dollar project in the city's Logan section will likely take years to become reality.
On an oven-hot summer morning, a band of men in blue jumpsuits are raking up trash tangled into the edges of North 9th Street near Roosevelt Boulevard. It's early, but they've got a lot of work ahead of them.
Got a bed for somebody to come clean up. It's just sad.
Through the brush just around the corner, longtime Logan resident Ernie Bristow stands by a vast expanse of grass and weeds. From a distance, it looks like the makings of a football field. But walk in and you'll find reminders of what once stood here and on nearly 20 blocks nearby. Houses, hundreds of them.
It's still devastating. You know, people don't want to come over on this area.
This is what's known as the Logan Triangle, an infamous 35-acre slice of North Philly history that residents, city officials, and a private developer now hope to rewrite. In the late 80s, the city started spending millions to demolish nearly 1,000 homes here. Millions more were spent relocating the people who lived in them. The reason? The properties were sinking. They were built in the 1920s on top of a creek bed filled in with ash and cinder. Over decades, that combination behaved like slow-moving quicksand and ultimately did in a once-thriving neighborhood. Helen Matthews has watched it all from her home across the street from the Triangle.
My children, when they were young, they was able to come in and out, and sometimes they forget to shut the door or lock the door. There was no problems. Nobody can do that now.
That history is part of what led the Goldenberg Group to ink a deal with the city after months of negotiations. Jeremy Fogel is the Montgomery County-based company's director of development. He says the scope of the project is still very much a work in progress and that neighbors will have a chance to help shape it.
We certainly see an opportunity to have some not-for-profit uses, some for-profit uses, some community open space, some improvements to transportation infrastructure, and some of those kind of broader brush, big-picture concepts that will need to be adopted into whatever specific design we eventually end up with.
Brian Abernathy is executive director of the Philadelphia Redevelopment Authority, which owns the land comprising the Triangle. He says it won't be easy or cheap to build there. As it stands today, only about half of the Logan Triangle is suitable for redevelopment. The center of the site is particularly unstable.
There's the potential that I fail, that the authority fails. The government subsidy that's going to be needed is pretty significant, and I can't promise that we're going to be successful in a year or 2 years or 3 years or 5 years. But I can commit that we're in it for the long haul, that the status quo was unacceptable. We have to figure this out. For the not just the future of Logan, but for the future of the city.
I was in the back room looking at television, and I heard a boom. And I jumped up out the bed and ran and started to look. And then I went to the front, and that's when I seen all the fire.
It all started in 1986 with a huge gas main explosion. The Valentine's Day blaze damaged several homes, but it also revealed just how badly properties in the Triangle were sinking. Deborah McCullough is the city's housing director.
As you drove along the boulevard and you looked over into Logan, you could literally see houses where the steps of the houses were higher than the front porches of the houses. And that's because the houses were heavier than the steps.
Within a year, the city started condemning properties and offering buyouts to residents of the Logan Triangle on a volunteer basis. A nonprofit, the Logan Assistance Corporation, was set up for the sole purpose of overseeing the process. The work was projected to take 3 years. It took the better part of two decades. The last family moved out in 2003.
I mean, it was a very difficult time. Some people wanted to leave. They really wanted to leave and get out of there. Other people didn't want to leave. They didn't believe the houses were really sinking, or they didn't believe that it was as bad as it was.
Over the years, two major development proposals were presented to city officials, including one from Goldenberg. Both called for large-scale housing. Both were rejected. Cost was a big factor, specifically the cost of preparing the land for redevelopment. Those are dollars the city would have had to provide. Big dollars. John Cromer directed the city's Office of Housing and Community Development when Ed Rendell was mayor.
For the first proposal, which came in I believe, 1993, the cost of the soil compaction alone, including compacting the areas where the new infrastructure, you know, the streets and the new sewer lines would have to be built, was $40 million in 1993 dollars. So, and that was just the start of it. So it clearly wasn't going to work.
Brian Abernathy with the Redevelopment Authority says it's unclear how much remediation would cost for the current project, but he estimates the final price tag could be upwards of $100 million. He says the new project may feature housing, but it's not guaranteed. Part of that decision will hinge on whether residents want to see that, and would people be willing to buy a house on land that is most famous for sinking. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania's Convention Center was in the spotlight as part of the World Meeting of Families and, more recently, the Forbes 30 Under 30 Summit. WHYY's Tom McDonald has an update on how the building is doing since a labor agreement designed to make it easier for convention planners.
Greg Talley of Talley Management Group ran logistics for the World Meeting of Families, which set up its security screenings and media headquarters at the Convention Center. He says there was a can-do attitude by everyone there, including the unions.
We didn't hear no in that building as we were going through this process on any level, whether that was from labor or from management or anywhere within the structure. What we heard was, what are you trying to accomplish? Let us give you some other ideas of how that might be possible, if my idea wasn't necessarily the best way.
Convention Center Board Chairman Greg Fox says the World Meeting of Families and Forum Summit are two examples of big events that went off without major problems, and they're winning back old customers.
We have, for example, Lightfare had been with us in the past, but then showed a great deal of hesitancy about coming again. But now they've signed up with us for 2017 and 2019.
Fox says the center has 10 big shows booked for next year and two dozen more smaller shows with an effort underway to continue booking the space. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
To what extent could your friends' Facebook comments on political candidates influence your vote? Well, a new study from the University of Delaware says yes, and by a lot. WHYY's Mark Eichmann has more from the Delaware desk.
We've grown used to getting cyber recommendations on hotels or restaurants, but what about deciding who to vote for based on internet comments and likes on social media? That's exactly what researchers at the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication tried to find out. Professor Paul Brewer and his team created a fake Facebook profile for a fake candidate. Their study found that voters' opinions could be manipulated by positive or negative comments about this fictitious candidate.
So if there are positive comments, the people who are viewing the page, they thought that they liked the candidate more. They thought the candidate had better qualities, and they were more likely to vote for the candidate. When they saw the negative comments, they were less likely to vote for the candidate. They thought more negative things about the candidate.
The study also examined the effectiveness of a candidate responding and rebutting negative comments.
And we found that what the candidate said didn't make any difference. It was all what these random commenters were saying.
So why do commenters hold more weight than the candidate?
What we think is going on is the voters, they discount what the candidate says because the candidate has an interest in trying to influence you.
Right.
But these other people, you know, there's no reason to think that they're trying to help the candidate or hurt the candidate. Voters just think they're saying what they really think.
So could this lead to more manipulation of social media comments by campaigns?
If they encourage their supporters to go on their Facebook page and say nice things, it seems like it would help them. If they even created fake Facebook accounts and did it, it could help them. You know, it also might pay for them to delete all the negative comments because they can do that on their Facebook page.
As the media landscape gets more and more fractured, Brewer expects the role of social media comments to grow even more powerful.
It's getting harder and harder to reach people through traditional methods like campaign ads. You know, there are so many outlets that people are watching. It's hard to reach them all. And campaigns really have to use all the tools available. And so this is something that's part of their campaign toolbox, and candidates are going to have to be more and more invested in this way of reaching voters.
From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, attorneys for New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez file a notice saying they'll appeal a judge's ruling in his corruption case. A federal judge last month dismissed some bribery counts against Menendez and a co-defendant, but rejected most of Menendez's arguments to dismiss the indictment. The judge yesterday rejected his remaining attempts to have the case thrown out. Republican presidential hopeful Chris Christie and his wife reported nearly $1 million in income last year. Tax returns released by the New Jersey governor's office today show the Christies made more than $970,000 in 2014, thanks largely to his wife's former high-paying Wall Street job. Light rain falling, 72 degrees at 6:16. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. This evening's forecast, periods of rain clearing overnight, low 56 degrees, giving way to a sunny Saturday, but cooler, tomorrow's high 66. Sunshine on Sunday as well, high near 70 degrees.
Well, why is it such a lovely day? Just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay.
Still ahead.
We kind of didn't want to do it any traditional way. So all of a sudden after a concert, Michael and I were driving home, and he said, I have a crazy idea. What would you think of getting married during a Philly Pops concert?
Did they make it happen? Find out when NewsWorks Tonight continues.
The University of Delaware MBA supports WHYY. The UD part-time MBA program offers busy professionals the opportunity to pursue their education and their careers. With flexible online and on-campus options and a variety of specializations, the program can be structured to meet both busy schedules and help with career advancement. October drop-in information sessions will be held Wednesday the 14th and Wednesday the 21st from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Learn more at udmba.com. The University of Delaware MBA. It is all about you.
21st Century North Dakota. Oil. Black gold, that is.
And when we initially pitched this idea, we pitched it as Fargo meets Deadwood. And the real place was very, very much like that.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Blood and Oil next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6:30 on WHYY.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. PAFA's undergraduate open house is Saturday, October 17th, from 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. A day filled with tours, panel discussions, and opportunities for one-on-one sessions with faculty and staff to answer all your questions about PAFA's four-year certificate and Bachelor of Fine Arts program. More information can be found at pafa.edu/openhouse. That's pafa.edu/openhouse.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The Gallup poll is pulling out of the presidential political horse race business. Joining me in the backstretch is Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Gallup was the most prolific pollster in the 2012 and then back the 28 campaigns as well. What's the calculus behind this new focus?
We have finite resources at Gallup, as is the case with most pollsters, and we're really thinking about what's the best way to use our research and polling in an election environment. And as you mentioned, in 2012, we spent a huge amount, a big proportion of all that we did, tracking night by night the horse race question, which is, you know, who would you vote for if you were going to vote today? And in looking ahead to this year, we're thinking that by shifting away from spending all that time just asking that question and spending more time asking Americans about what are your priorities for the presidential candidates, where do you stand on the key issues of the day, what about the campaigns is filtering through to you as a person, we could do a better job of helping us move forward in the election environment, that is representing the people, than if we're consistently only focusing on this one question, who would you vote for if you could vote today?
Critics wonder the extent to which it also comes in response to polling, specifically with the 2012 presidential race, the final poll, Mitt Romney, Barack Obama.
I don't think that has anything to do with it at all. Clearly, we talked about reviewed our methods very carefully after 2012. We've made some revisions. We do a lot of testing with elections anyhow. So we certainly feel that our methods, the way that we do polling are quite accurate and right in the ballpark with everyone else. So that's why we're continuing to poll and ask questions about a wide variety of things. So it's not in reaction to any kind of question about the validity of methods in general polling today. It's really more just a question of where are polling resources, at least for Gallup, best spent.
Speak to the increasing trend of aggregate polling and how that might diminish Gallup's singular role.
Well, of course, this is something that's happening across polling in general. In fact, it's happening in a lot of different places, like in medicine. We have meta-analyses of what's happening. But clearly, when the horse race numbers are presented today, a lot of times people look at sites and others who pool together a bunch of individual surveys and then say, all right, here's the average of where we are today. Again, that is a change and a trend in the industry, but that's not the major factor that was part of our thinking.
Does this decision only impact the primary contests, or will it be followed through the general election?
We haven't made any final decisions on exactly what we'll be doing, but I can tell you that we will be spending as much time as we can next year focusing on where the people stand on issues and priorities and what they want to be done, for example, about government, which is in such low esteem right now. Approval for Congress is down in the 14% range. We now have a majority of Americans who say most members of Congress are corrupt. Most members of Congress are more focused on special interests than on the people. Most members of Congress are out of touch. I mean, 69% of Americans say most members of Congress are more focused on special interests. And now we have increasing numbers of Americans who say even their own member of Congress, whom they usually look at more positively, are corrupt and focused on special interests and so forth. So in general, Congress, the legislative branch, is held in very low esteem right now, and I'm sure what's happening there now isn't doing a lot to increase that.
And the disdain isn't apparently limited to what doesn't get done. I understand Gallup polled on whether folks feel the federal government poses an immediate threat to rights and freedoms.
Yes, and that's the wording. That sounds pretty draconian, doesn't it? Does the federal government pose an immediate threat to the rights and freedoms of ordinary citizens or not? And we now have 49%, let me repeat that, 49%, basically half of Americans who say yes, they agree with that. So that sounds pretty dramatic when Americans are worried about government. I don't think that this means Americans are afraid that government agents are going to come blast down their front door and arrest them on the spot. I think it's just a representation of the overall more general negativity that Americans have towards government.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. It's hard to find a production of the stage version of Cole Porter's High Society. The musical is rarely performed. But the Walnut Street Theater is reviving the show, and WHYY Theater blogger Howard Shapiro says it's a treat.
It's a good bet you never saw the stage musical of High Society, jammed with Cole Porter songs from the movie of the same name and from other shows he scored. Not even Cole Porter saw it. He was already dead about 35 years when it played Broadway in 1998, where it lasted less than half a year. The Walnut's current production is not just a rare glimpse, it's also terrific fun and entirely fitting, because High Society is a musical spin-off of the play and movie The Philadelphia Story, with the same characters and plot, but set in a mansion on Long Island's Oyster Bay. There, a divorced and carefree young socialite is about to marry a stuffed shirt guy when her dashing former husband crashes the wedding weekend. Arthur Copit wrote the screwball script, and Porter's lyrics are great at capturing the upper class. As for the Walnuts production, you can't beat director Frank Anzalone's staging of this busy musical with people rushing in and out amid a lot of hanky-panky, especially in the second act. You'll recognize plenty of Porter's pieces from the American Songbook. Here's Paul Schaefer, who played Broadway in Phantom of the Opera.
Crazy flames, one of those bells that...
At the Walnut, he's the divorced husband of the socialite, portrayed with gusto by Megan Nicole Arnoldi. That's a little sampling of the great Porter songs in a show that turns out to be a swell party. High Society runs at the Walnut through October 25th. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
This weekend, the Philly Pops Orchestra will open its concert season with a wedding. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the Pops Concertmaster will marry one of the violin players during a tribute to Frank Sinatra.
The Philly Pops will play Frank Sinatra this weekend to mark the 100th anniversary of the birth of Old Blue Eyes, and two musicians in the orchestra, Concertmaster Michael Ludwig and violinist Rachel Mathey, will tie the knot during the concert. After getting engaged a little over a year ago, Mathey says they started looking for a novel way to get hitched.
We were kind of grappling with the way that we were going to get married, and we kind of didn't want to do it any traditional way. So all of a sudden, after a concert, Michael and I were driving home, and he said, "I have a crazy idea. What would you think of getting married during a Philly Pops concert?" And I said, "Wow, that would be incredible. Can we make it happen?"
The Pops first tried to include the wedding as part of its outdoor summer concerts, but balked at the possibility of a rainout. This concert worked out because, as it happens, bride and groom are both big fans of Frank Sinatra, whose part will be sung by Michael Andrew.
Well, this is just really fortuitous timing.
This is Michael Ludwig, the groom.
And it is really interesting because we're kind of a private couple, and we are sharing like one of the most intimate moments of our lives with people, but we're sharing it with really special people. We're sharing it with our family and our friends and our colleagues and so many people that we love and that love us. So it just feels wonderful.
There will be 65 invited wedding guests among the 2,000 audience members. Following the concert will be a private reception. This will be a working wedding for the two musicians. At a certain point in the concert, Mathey will excuse herself from the stage to change into her wedding gown. And after the wedding, she will perform the rest of the concert, still wearing the gown. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
A bunch of angels cheer because we're together.
Finally, Lucy, the six-story-tall wooden elephant built in 1881 to attract potential home buyers, has been long in need of repairs, now totaling close to $60,000. In spite of Lucy not being, real, animal rights organization PETA has stepped forward to shoulder some of the costs, but with an unusual caveat. PETA wants the town of Margate to let Lucy serve as an inanimate advocate for their cause. The group is requesting that the attraction be adorned with a message highlighting the unfair treatment of elephants in captivity in zoos. No word yet on whether the town intends to take PETA up on their offer. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from Brett Rader and our intern, Kevin Rowley. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Al Banks, Adam Staniszewski, and Diana Martinez. Joyce Lieberman is our radio engineering supervisor. John Lussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Virtua proudly supports WHYY. This is the time of year to sign up for health insurance. When choosing a health insurance plan, it's important to know whether your doctor or hospital is included. If you want to use a Virtua physician, hospital, or outpatient service, you can find out if Virtua is in the plan you're considering by calling 888-VIRTUA-3. That's 888-VIRTUA-3. Virtua proudly supports WHYY.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.